Good afternoon, this is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. I'm doing this recording for the Thursday, November 19th time slot. So, what's happening in the world of astronomy? Well, everything's happening in the world of astronomy every day. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about what I heard on a TV program about the inner planets. And one thing that really caught my attention was about Mercury. So I've talked a bit about before how Jupiter wasn't always in its present orbit. In the early solar system, Jupiter moved in and towards the Sun. It went to the orbit of Mars. And of course, this is what astronomers believe, and they have strong reasons to believe that Jupiter did this. Saturn then moved in towards the Sun and somehow pulled Jupiter back out into its present orbit. So now we have the stable orbit of the planets. On this particular show I was listening to with Professor Brian Cox, the first topic was the planet Mercury. So the planet Mercury is very close to the Sun. It's in a highly elliptical orbit. So that's one of the reasons that astronomers believe. So they're not so certain about Mercury, but there's certain facts about the planet Mercury that make them believe that it was once not in its present spot. So I think they said that Mercury's day is twice as long as its year. So there's a 3-to-2 orbital resonance that causes this. So you can imagine that the surface of Mercury is very hot. But the other side, which is not exposed to the Sun, is very cold. And this just makes you remember something about Neptune. I think Neptune is way far out there. And I believe, or Uranus, I'm not sure which of the two, but it's like a situation where in the Arctic in the winter, there's 24 hours of night. So there's no sun, they don't see the sun, and of course, in the summer, they'll have 24 hours of sun. But one of the outer planets, one of its faces, or one half of the planet, does not face the sun for about, I believe, it was 14 years. So that part is in total darkness for 14 Earth years. So what happens with Mercury, though, it's strange that its day is twice as long as its year. And the talk about Mercury mostly on this show was how Mercury was not in its present orbit. So one of the things they think about that, they think that happened because the way its highly elliptical orbit of the planet Mercury. So they presented their story and they said Mercury was before around the present orbit of Mars. So I'm not sure how that could happen, how these planets can move in and out and be in the same orbit of another planet and not collide. But anyway, that's what they said. So something caused Mercury to start moving inwards towards the Sun. And why this didn't disappear into the Sun, that wasn't made clear. But I was thinking that too. There was probably some other planets that formed. And if it's true about this planet moving hypothesis where some planets move in, some planets move out, it's possible some planets could have just went right into the Sun and be burnt away. So anyway, Mercury didn't do that. It slowly started moving in towards the Sun and then it stabilized in its present orbit. So it's very highly elliptical. I think its farthest approach is almost twice as much distance as its closest approach to the Sun. So that was one of the things that made studying Mercury very difficult, because I believe it's the Mariner program or the Mariner spacecraft that went to Mercury. And it was, of course, Mercury is much farther than the Moon. So when the Moon, when spacecraft went to the Moon or when astronauts went to the Moon, it's very close. They don't have to do the really high speeds that it takes to go to a planet. So Mercury is very far away. It takes longer to get there, so of course they're going to go at a much higher speed. And the moon, it's quite close, so you don't have to go that fast to get there, because if it takes you a couple days, that's okay. So some of these spacecrafts that go to the outer planets or inner planets, they travel a long distance. So that's what's going to happen with Mars. It's going to, one of the things they would have to take into account was that Mars is really far away. So because Mars is really far away, it's going to take a higher speed. So when they get there, it's going to take more fuel to basically slow down the spacecraft so it can enter Mars orbit. So when the spacecraft went to Mercury, that I believe the first Mariner, it was quite at a high speed, so it took, the spacecraft had to kind of follow behind Venus when it got there, Mercury. So it had to orbit five times before it was captured into Mercury's orbit. So these are all complications or logistics that these astronomers have to figure out before going to, let's say, a faraway place. So when the spacecraft got there, it found that, of course, Mercury's surface was very cratered. And another discovery, I'm not sure if this was discovered before going to Mercury or after, but 85% of the planet is core. So there's only 15% of the planet is like Earth. We have a core, and then we have lava flowing around inside. And then there's a crust. But the core of Mercury is 85%. So basically, this tells astronomers that Mercury could have been hit by another planetoid or something big, and a lot of the crust or, you know, the surface could have been shot up into the air. But anyway, Mercury has 85%, I believe it's iron core, and then it travels in a highly elliptical orbit. And there could have been other things, but basically this has made scientists conclude, or astronomers conclude, that Mercury was not in its present orbit at the beginning. These are, of course, these conclusions are reached after scientists weigh all the data, and then they make this conclusion. So, of course, we weren't there at the beginning when this happened, or through Mercury's life, so that was interesting itself, all these, and there's probably a lot of other facts about Mercury. Now, moving on to Venus, it was possible that Venus was like Earth-like, almost, its surface millions or billions of years ago, and then this runaway greenhouse effect happened on Venus. So the Soviets, I believe, launched quite a few spacecraft to go to Mercury, and they would always fail for some reason or another. And Mercury's atmosphere is so thick it was difficult to see through from Earth. So when the first successful pictures from Mercury came from a spacecraft that successfully landed on it, the spacecraft didn't last very long. It was crushed out of existence. So Mercury is a hellish planet, and as I said, it could have been Earth-like at the beginning of its life. And Earth at the beginning was, I believe, the oceans were a different color and the sky might have been orange. So the organisms that, the life that took form in the beginning and that breathed out oxygen, that's what gave the Earth its oxygen. So there's all these interesting things about the planet. And of course, there are a lot of them that you're not sure our scientists are not sure of their conclusions, but they make these models and these theories, and some of them, like Jupiter's movement at the beginning of the solar system and years after that, they are pretty certain about that. But Mercury, there's a lot of speculation. So these, again, are interesting ways to learn about astronomy because you sit on your couch comfortably and you just watch the show. It's very entertaining. They're good shows. And, of course, I love learning about astronomy. So a lot of the time I watch BBC Earth 248 and sometimes 247. And there's sometimes the Knowledge Network puts on very good shows. There was another show on CBC about the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he's done this a few times. I think he's an astrophysicist, but he talks about certain things about life itself and the complexity of life. And one of the things he was talking about was the other night was about how a big tree, let's say an invasive species, lands on it. So some kind of worm or bug or something gets on its bark. Somehow the tree can sense it, and it takes longer than a human being who would, for example, if a bug or bee was around me or landed on me, I would instantaneously move my hand to shoo the bee away. But what happened with the tree, it takes a couple of hours for the sensation to somehow get processed, and the tree then says, oh, okay, now I got an invasive species on me. So the tree sends some kind of secretion down its root or down its bark, and it tries to attract other species that will kill this or get this invasive species off it. So a lot of these astrophysicists that before I thought all they would talk about were things like I was interested in was supernovas and things like that. And all these like high energy physics things, topics. But Neil deGrasse Tyson was talking about the complexity of life. And it is very fascinating how life has evolved in this on this planet, because in the beginning you had, I forget what it was called, but it's a bacteria and didn't have any eyes, didn't have a backbone, didn't have sensations like we have now, and how life evolved into so many different forms and so many complex things like what the tree does. And also when Brian Cox was looking at something, it looked at the eyes of some bugs, and wow, life has been really interesting. One of the things some astronomers are even bio astronomers are looking at, if they do find life, will it be the same as life here? So they're hoping it's not. They're hoping it's, but then again they say, well, they take a different species like a bat and, or let's say a bird and a human being, they're different. They there was a split in their evolutionary path, of course. Birds can fly, humans can't, but we both have eyesight, and an octopus has eyesight. All these things have eyesight, so even though they diverged and evolved differently, they evolved the same mechanisms. So they're wondering, will life elsewhere have, will it evolve the same mechanisms that we have, or birds have, or snakes have, whatever. So it's interesting to listen to these astronomers who are astrophysicists, but they also talk about biology and things like that. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to go for a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more astronomy. So this is Marco, you're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Accessibility,
disability,
mental health,
ADHD and ADD,
and many, many more topics we explore and cover.
But where?
On CITR's All Access Pass.
A unique and collectively run show on equity, inclusion, and creating awareness for people of all abilities in BC and around the world.
Catch us every other Wednesday afternoon from 3 to 4.
If you want more info or want to get involved, please find us on Facebook or send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Are you interested in human rights and social justice? Come check out Amnesty International UBC. We fight to stop human rights violations all over the world, including here in Canada. Our club hosts letter writing sessions, social events, documentary nights, bar fundraisers, and current events discussions on a bi-weekly basis. So keep your ears open and check out our Amnesty International UBC Facebook page for more information. We look forward to promoting human rights with you.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. So now I'm going to get into the, whenever I look on these websites, for example, Life Science or NASA.gov, they don't talk about any bioastronomy topics, and I hope I can find one time, because they are very interesting how some things can be so complex, and they bring out, like Brian Cox or Neil deGrasse Tyson, they give you so much information on such interesting topics. And of course it's about astronomy in a way, because we are in the universe, so we're part of the universe. So the story of the universe is our story too. And what makes it wonderful is we're the only proof or example of life anywhere in the universe. But then what was interesting about one of those physicists were talking about, well, why hasn't life contacted us? Why hasn't other intelligent life contacted us? And one of the things they said is these other advanced, I'm not sure what they call them, alien species, they might just view us as we view a bug, and they might just step on us. The other thing is there were so many millions and billions of years that have gone by in the early universe, 13 point something billion years. So it's possible they would try to contact other civilizations. That's the word I was looking at. But they could have been expired. Like, for example, our sun in 500 million years, and this was a reset, because before they thought it was going to be longer, but within 500 million years, animals will no longer exist because it'll be too hot on the earth. And it could be changed again because these things change. So now I'm going to talk about something about astronomy itself, not just life, but anyway, just hardcore astronomy, where this is what I used to always be fascinated in. Just that, not about life in the solar system or life in the galaxy or life somewhere else. This story is on LifeScience.com. It's called Newfound Kraken Merger May Have Been the Biggest Collision in Milky Way's History. So this was a day ago, which means it was on Tuesday, November 17th on LifeScience.com. And it's somebody called Brandon Spector, a senior writer. And it says, Newfound Kraken Merger May Have Been the Biggest Collision in Milky Way's History. So the subtitle is, Our Galaxy Was Built on Collisions, and this one may be the largest ever. So when we're talking about large things, you automatically think, well, Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy are the two biggest galaxies in our local group, and we're circled by them. So they're in our orbit, in the Milky Way's orbit, the Large and Small Magellanic Cloud. They orbit the Milky Way, and they're much smaller, and there's always proof that, I believe it's called the Magellanic Stream, where the stars from the Large Magellanic Cloud are being ripped away, and the Large Magellanic Cloud is being shredded up by the tidal forces of the gravity of our Milky Way galaxy. So they see this coming in, this Magellanic Stream, and they believe within a certain umpteen years, the Large and Small Magellanic Cloud will probably be totally eaten up by the Milky Way galaxy. So these are much smaller galaxies. But when you look at, I believe it's called the Tarantula Nebula, astronomers believe that's the biggest nebula in bigger than anything in the Milky Way. So even though they're smaller, they have a big inner nebula called the Tarantula Nebula. And of course, in 1987, in the Southern Hemisphere, people in the Southern Hemisphere witnessed supernova 1987A. So even though it's a smaller galaxy, it's had a supernova in the past. And we haven't for 400 years, so we're still waiting for that. And again, I mentioned this, I think, last week, that it's possible if a supernova happens on the other side of the galaxy, and it's right on the plane of the galaxy, where all a lot of stars are, it would be difficult to see because of all the gas, the dust, the stars in the way. But apparently there has not been a supernova in our galaxy since 1602, so that's over 418 years. So astronomers are anxiously waiting that, because they believe for every galaxy there's one supernova per 100 years. So now I'm going to talk about the newfound Kraken merger may have been the biggest collision in Milky Way history. So there's a photo here. It says a globular cluster, yellow, glows in the Large Magellanic Cloud, one of the Milky Way's smaller satellite galaxies. Astronomers studied clusters like these to recreate the ancient mergers that made the Milky Way galaxy what it is. So here's the story. The Milky Way contains more than 100 billion stars, but it didn't come by them all honestly. So when they say 100 billion stars, I've heard figures 300 million or 300 billion, 400 million. So now they're saying 100 billion. So there could be up to 400 billion stars in our galaxy. And I believe the Andromeda has a trillion stars in the galaxy. So I'm going to start again. The Milky Way contains more than 100 billion stars, but it didn't come by them all honestly. At least a dozen times over the last 12 billion years, the Milky Way collided with a neighboring galaxy and devoured it, swallowing up that neighbor's stars and mixing them into an ever-growing stew of pilfered suns. With each galactic merger, the shape, size, and motion of our galaxy changed forever, ultimately becoming the iconic spiral we recognize today. Now, in a recent study published in October 2020 issue of the journal Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, researchers have attempted to unwind that spiral using artificial intelligent AI to match distant clusters of stars by their ages, motions, and chemical compositions. The team found evidence of 5 large-scale galactic mergers, each involving 100 million stars or more, dating back more than 10 billion years, including one ancient collision that has never been described before. So isn't that wonderful how scientists can match clusters of stars by their age, motions, and chemical compositions and find that, oh, well, this could have been, or we do believe that this was part of a large-scale merger. It's totally fascinating to me how they can go back millions or billions of years and bring up these facts. This newfound crash with the so-called Kraken galaxy not only helps fill in the Milky Way's mysterious family tree, but could also help astronomers piece together what our galaxy looked like in its earliest days, the study authors said. So says Diederik Crudsen, an astronomer at the University of Heidelberg in Germany, and quote, "The collision with Kraken may have been the most significant merger the Milky Way galaxy ever experienced. The merger with Kraken took place 11 billion years ago, when the Milky Way was 4 times less massive than today. As a result, the collision may have truly transformed what the Milky Way looked like at that time." End quote. So this was called the Kraken galaxy, the Kraken merger. And that's why the Seattle hockey team are now called the Seattle Kraken. I don't know, is there a link? Maybe there is, maybe there's not. In their new study, Crudsen and colleagues used computer simulations to analyze all the known globular clusters, old dense spheres of up to 1 million stars that all formed around the same time as each other within the Milky Way. Our galaxy hosts at least 150 of these clusters, which astronomers believe are fossils of the ancient galaxies that the Milky Way gobbled up over its long and hungry history. The researchers trained an owl. The researchers trained an AI, so that's artificial intelligence algorithm, to identify globular clusters based on their shared properties of stars, at first running the algorithm on thousands of simulated galaxies. Once the algorithm was able to accurately predict the formation, evolution, and destruction of globular clusters in those imaginary galaxies, the team set their AI loose on the Milky Way. So here's a photo that shows the Milky Way, Kraken, Sequoia, Sagittarius, Hemhe streams, and Gaia, Gaia, Enceladus. So these were believed to be mergers. This is an image from the new study, shows the five major mergers that made the Milky Way what it is today. That's very interesting stuff. So it's interesting, they show, I'm not sure if this is a timeline. Yes, it is. There's a timeline. So apparently, the first one that happened was Sagittarius, then Sequoia, Kraken, Hemhe streams, and Gaia, Enceladus. So again, this article is called, it's a very interesting article, Newfound Kraken Merger May Have Been the Biggest Collision in Milky Way's History. So this is on livescience.com, dated Tuesday, November 17th. Using data obtained by the Gaia Space Probe, which has given us the most complete map of the Milky Way, the algorithm analyzed the ages, movements, and chemical compositions of known globular clusters in our galaxy in order to recreate the cosmic mergers that landed them there. The team's analysis accurately predicted four known mergers in the Milky Way's past, including the so-called Gaia Sausage Merger, which added several billion stars to our galaxy's bulge about 9 billion years ago, as well as the previously unknown Kraken Merger. And that merger was a beast. According to the team's results, the Kraken may have been the largest and oldest galactic collision in the Milky Way's history. So one of the things that I'm thinking about, that this has spurred a thought in my mind, which is a dangerous thing, of course, that some of these mergers may have wiped out stars, planets, or civilizations that existed before. So there's the famous Drake equation that talks about, I believe it talks about, something about life and the probability of life existing or something like that. So one of the things that could be built into the Drake equation was that, do galactic mergers themselves destroy civilizations? Because when another galaxy comes and collides with ours, and it's possible that these galactic collisions are very slow, they don't cause as much havoc as someone might originally think, but it's possible that they could be one of the reasons that certain civilizations have been wiped out. So the Kraken merger was a beast. According to the team's results, the Kraken may have been the largest and oldest galactic collision in the Milky Way's history. The merger occurred when the Milky Way was only a fraction of its current size, and may have added to our galaxy 13 globular clusters that are still identifiable today. While the Gaia Sausage merger ultimately added more solar mass to the Milky Way, more than 20 globular clusters worth, than the Kraken one, our galaxy was considerably bigger when the Sausage merger happened and was less likely susceptible to major structural changes, the researchers wrote. Yeah, so that's interesting. It makes sense that if galaxies collide, there's going to be a structural change. So I think that astronomers already have models or computer simulations of what's going to happen when the Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxy merge. And they're going to be a different shape, and would the cores of the two galaxies merge, stuff like that. So there's all these fun things that astronomers do, so that's why they don't need to play video games, because they're doing all these mergers and all these simulations that were very interesting. This newfound merger is only one small piece of the puzzle. Because the road to galaxy formation is strewn with collisions like these, it's likely that many more small-scale mergers also contributed to the Milky Way we know today. Astronomers suspect that at least 15 other mergers may be lurking in our galaxy's past that each involve 10 billion stars or more, and their remnants are just waiting to be found in our galaxy's globular guts. So says Crutzen, and quote, the debris of more than 5 progenitor galaxies has now been identified. With current and upcoming telescopes, it should be all possible, should be possible to find evidence of them all. End quote. Astronomers have about 3 or 4 billion years to figure it out. Following that, another galaxy-altering merger will occur when the neighboring Andromeda galaxy, currently 2.5 million light years away, and the Milky Way will ultimately collide. Isn't that always the way? Just when you think you know a galaxy, it goes and changes on you again. That was a nice galaxy, or a nice story. What was I going to say? Yes, so it's currently 2.5 million light years away. And I did read once about the speed of the two galaxies, the Milky Way and Andromeda, relative to each other, because they are moving together and they're going to merge in 3 or 4 billion years. So I guess if you somehow do the math, you can find out how long it's going to take. Oh, no, it's going to take 3 or 4 billion years, but if they're 2.5 million light years away, then you can figure out the speed of the two galaxies relative to each other. So I think that was a very nice article, very interesting. It just brings to light that what I said at the beginning of the show, there's always something going about in astronomy, and there's so many interesting research topics, and there's probably so much research, you just can never study everything. And it's all very interesting. So I'm going to go on to the next topic. It was in this article, and it said 11 fascinating facts about our Milky Way galaxy. Oh yeah, I forgot to mention about the space launch. I think the SpaceX, they went to the space station. It's not in itself interesting in itself, because there's been a lot of launches to the International Space Station, but I believe this is the first SpaceX launch that carried astronauts to the space station. So I'll talk about that a bit later. First, I'm going to talk about 11 fascinating facts about our Milky Way galaxy. So here it shows our Milky Way galaxy. How much do we know about the city you live in? Sure, you've got your favorite restaurants and the best way to avoid traffic, but it's unlikely you know the details of every nook and cranny. Same goes for the galaxy you live in, the Milky Way. Our celestial home is an awe-inspiring place full of stars, supernovas, nebulas, energy and dark matter, but many aspects of it remain mysterious, even to scientists. For those seeking to better know their own place in the universe, here are 11 enlightening facts about the Milky Way. So the Milky Way's name is ancient. That's fact number one. So I think everybody, well, most people know that. Somehow the Greeks believed that one of the goddesses of their lore was nursing the child, and the milk spilled across the sky. So they said, well, that's why we're going to call it the Milky Way, because all those stars are like milk. So that's basically why the Milky Way is called the Milky Way. So a lot of the things about astronomy were discovered before, and the Greeks or Persians gave their names to a lot of things in astronomy. Second fact is, we're not exactly sure how many stars are in the Milky Way. So that's what I said at the beginning. Sometimes I say 100 billion, sometimes 400 billion. So counting stars is a tedious business. Even astronomers argue over the best way to do it. There's telescopes see only the brightest stars in our galaxy, and many are hidden by obscuring gas and dust. Our technique to estimate the stellar population of the Milky Way is to look at how fast stars are orbiting within it, which gives an indication of the gravitational tug, and therefore the mass of the galaxy. Divide the galactic mass by the average size of a star, and you should have your answer. But as David Cornrich, an astronomer at Ithaca College in New York, told Live Science, those numbers are all approximations. Stars vary widely in size, and many assumptions go into estimating the number of stars residing in the galaxy. The European Space Agency's Gaia satellite has mapped the location of 1 billion stars in our galaxy, And scientists believe this represents 1% of the total. So perhaps the Milky Way contains about 100 billion stars. So, as I said before, I thought it was something like 400 billion stars. Okay. So anyway, third fact, nobody knows how much the Milky Way weighs. On a related note, astronomers are still unsure exactly how much our galaxy weighs, with estimates from 700 billion to 2 trillion solar masses. Getting a better grasp is no easy task. Most of the Milky Way's mass, perhaps 85%, is in dark matter, so it's hard to know. So the Milky Way is probably in a big empty spot in the universe. Several studies have indicated that the Milky Way and its neighbors are living out in the boonies of the cosmos. From afar, the large-scale structure of the universe looks like a colossal cosmic web, with string-like filaments connecting dense regions separated by enormous, mostly empty voids. The emphasis in that last sentence should be on mostly empty, since our own galactic abode seems to be an inhabitant of the Keenan, Barger, and Kawi KBC. What is KBC again? Should be here and I should know it, but anyway. Void, named after three astronomers who identified it in a 2013 study in the Astrophysical Journal. Last year, a separate team looked at the motion of galaxies in the cosmic web to provide additional confirmation that we're floating in one of the big empty areas. So small galaxies orbit the Milky Way and sometimes crash into it. That's another fact. When Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan sailed through the southern hemisphere in the 16th century, he and his crew were among the first Europeans to report on circular clusters of stars in the night sky, according to the European Southern Observatory. These clusters are actually small galaxies that orbit our Milky Way like planets around a star, and they have been named the Small and Large Magellanic Clouds. Many such dwarf galaxies orbit ours, and sometimes they get eaten by our own massive Milky Way. Earlier this year, astronomers used new data from the Gaze satellite that showed millions of stars in our galaxy moving in similar, narrow, needle-like orbits, suggesting they all originate from an earlier dwarf galaxy dubbed the Gaia Sausage, as Live Science reported at the time. So we talked about that. And, of course, to me, it's totally fascinating how astronomers can identify different areas of the Milky Way and say, oh, this came from a earlier merger, things like that. So it's interesting what astronomers can find out. Okay, another fact is the Milky Way is full of toxic grease. Swirling through the mostly empty space between our stars and our galaxy is a bunch of dirty grease. Oily organic molecules known as aliphatic carbon compounds are produced in certain types of stars, then are leaked out into interstellar space. A recent study found that these grease-like substances could account for between a quarter and one half of the Milky Way's interstellar carbon, five times more than previously believed. Though strange, the findings are cause for optimism, according to researchers, because carbon is an essential building block of living things. Finding an abundance of the galaxy could suggest that another star system harbors life. Another fact, we talked about this before, the Milky Way is going to crash with its neighbor in 4 billion years. Is it 4 billion years? Yes, 4 billion years. So basically, I believe that what happens at first is the Andromeda and the Milky Way will fly past each other, and then they will come back together and somehow merge. So I don't think we'll be there. I won't be there, so no need to worry. But again, a lot of the space in a galaxy is just empty space. So who knows how many stars will actually collide. But maybe stars will be perturbed and knocked out of their orbit, or planets or something. So it's going to be an interesting thing that's going to happen. And scientists have seen these mergers in galaxies far away. Sad to say, but our galaxy isn't going to be here forever. Astronomers know that we are currently speeding toward the Milky Way, or the Andromeda, at around 250,000 miles per hour, which is 400,000 kilometers per hour. So that's what I was looking at before. So we're moving towards Andromeda at 250,000 miles per hour, or 400,000 kilometers per hour. So at that rate, I think 400,000 kilometers is the distance between Earth and the Moon. So at that speed, we can get to the moon in 1 hour. When the crash comes in about 4 billion years, most research has suggested that the more massive Andromeda galaxy would swallow up our own and survive. But in a recent study, astronomers reweighed Andromeda and found that it has roughly equivalent to 800 billion suns, or about on par with the Milky Way's mass, as Live Science previously reported. This means that exactly which galaxy will emerge less scathed from the future galactic crash remains an open question. Okay, stars from our galactic neighbors are racing towards the Milky Way. Now that's interesting. Movie stars and film are known to swap a bit, but who knows? Who knew that galaxies in the universe sometimes swap stars? So they swap stars. How's that happen? I guess that could mean that could be that a star is perturbed or shot out due to sorry, I wasn't sure. Good. I thought I pressed a button and I thought my recorder went off, but it didn't. So they're perturbed and they're shot out. So researchers were recently searching for hypervelocity stars, which get thrown at mind-bending speeds from the Milky Way after interacting with the giant black hole in its center. What they found was even stranger. Rather than flying away from our galaxy, most of the fast stars they spotted were barreling towards us. These could be stars from another galaxy zooming right through the Milky Way. So says Tommaso Marchetti, an astronomer at Leiden University in the Netherlands. They also suggest that these odd stars could have originated in the Large Magellanic Cloud or some other galaxy farther away. And they write in their paper that the discovered objects may constitute the tip of the iceberg of a large population of similar stars. Okay. Next fact, there are mysterious bubbles arising out of the Milky Way. So it shows the Milky Way, the plane, and at the center there's gamma ray emissions, X-ray emissions, and they are shooting these blobs out at top and bottom. Imagine discovering that your living room, which you've seen a million times before, contained a previously unnoticed elephant. That's more or less what happened to scientists in 2010, when they uncovered a gigantic, never-before-seen structure, stretching for 25,000 light years above and below the galaxy, named Fermi bubbles after the telescope that found them. These gamma-ray-emitting objects had defied astronomers' explanations ever since. Last year, a team gathered evidence suggesting that the bubbles are the aftermath of an energetic event 6 million to 9 million years ago, when the supermassive black hole in the galactic center swallowed a huge clump of gas and dust and burped out the giant glowing clouds, according to NASA. Okay. So, let's see. Next fact, our galaxy is being bombarded with bizarre energy pulses from the other side of the universe. It shows here an image credit of something. It's a bright object. I'll read on and see what it is. Over the last decade, astronomers keep detecting odd flashes of light coming at them from the distant cosmos, known as fast radio bursts, or FRBs. These mysterious signals have no agreed-upon explanation. Despite knowing about them for more than 10 years, researchers had until recently captured only 30 or so examples of these FRBs. But in a recent study, Australian scientists managed to find 20 more FRBs, nearly doubling the number of known objects, as Live Science previously reported. While they still don't know the odd flash's origins, the team was able to determine that the light had traveled through several billion light years of gas and dust, which imparted telltale signs on the signal, suggesting that the FRBs were coming from quite a long way away. Okay, so that's finished that article itself about some interesting facts about the Milky Way. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to go for another break. When we come back, we're going to talk more astronomy. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.
The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members. Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk. And there's an interesting article I came across. It's called Physicists Discover the Kings and Queens of Quantumness. But I'm going to skip that because I don't have much time left. Maybe I could talk about it next time, but this is about the SpaceX launch. So when I heard it on the news that there were astronauts going into space, I said, well, that's happened before, hasn't it? There's always astronauts going to the space station. There's been astronauts going to the moon. And I'm still waiting for when astronauts are going to go on joyrides. Or they're going to send them up into space and just fly through space, see how fast they can go. Go on a little ride here, turn around, go here, go there. Now, that would be fun. I think the astronauts would like it, too. So I don't know why they're not doing that. They might do that one day. But this one is about SpaceX. SpaceX crew Dragon launches 4 astronauts to space in historic flights. This is 3 days ago, so it's November 16th, I believe. And the subtitle is, SpaceX has officially begun space taxi missions for NASA. So that's one of the things I believe about the Artemis Moon program. There's so many private companies that are going to be brought into it. And I think that's going to happen within 4 years, where humans are on the moon again. And so SpaceX is going to be one of the big players in this all. And of course, this is exciting news. But again, I said, well, they've launched astronauts to the moon, to the space station before. So I believe this is the first one that SpaceX has done where it's actually carried astronauts. So I'm going to read on and see if that's true. So this is in Cape Canaveral, Florida. SpaceX successfully launched its first operational space taxi flight for NASA Sunday, November 15th, as a shiny white Falcon 9 rocket took to the skies above Kennedy Space Center here in Florida. The rocket lifted off from NASA's historic pad 39 here at 7:27 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I saw that historic pad 39. It was very cool. On November 16th, carrying 4 astronauts and a Crew Dragon capsule to orbit and then returned to Earth for a drone ship landing in the Atlantic Ocean. SpaceX Crew Dragon 1 is bound for the International Space Station, ISS, but instead of the traditional crew supplies and research experiments its cargo variant normally carries, this spacecraft carried a different type of cargo into space. 3 astronauts, Mike Hopkins, Victor Glover, Shannon Walker, and Japanese astronaut Soichi Noguchi. And of course, we can't forget that it also carried a baby Yoda plush doll. So there was 5. Not just people. Yoda's a person. So there's a baby Yoda doll on the International Space Station now. Going into the launch, the only concern was the weather. Rough seas at the recovery zone prevented the Dragon from getting off the ground on its original launch date on Saturday. Teams decided to delay the flight 24 hours in hopes that the drone ship just read the instructions would arrive at the recovery zone in time for the launch. So here it shows a picture of a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and Crew Dragon spacecraft lift off for the Crew 1 mission to the International Space Station. Beautiful. The gumdrop-shaped capsule's flight was one for the history books. It marked several firsts, including the first long-duration crew mission to blast off from the space coast, as well as the first operational commercial crew mission to launch as part of NASA's commercial crew program. With the launch of a different Crew Dragon capsule in May, known as the Demo 2 mission, NASA and SpaceX helped usher in a new era in spaceflight, one led by commercial companies. That must be exciting Elon Musk, he's doing all this. I believe he's got a master's degree in engineering, I'm not sure, or a PhD. But it's so cool, he has his own company that can launch spacecraft. Incredible. Nearly a decade ago, on July 21st, 2011, the space shuttle Atlantis touched down for the final time, ending the storied career of NASA's fleet of space shuttles. The winged family of orbiters were NASA's workhorses for decades, first flying in 1981 and continuing service until 2011. The space shuttle helped build the International Space Station, which celebrated its 20th anniversary earlier this month. But the shuttle's time was limited, and just before its retirement, NASA decided that it wanted to hand over the reins to private industry and entrusted two companies to ferry their astronauts to and from space. NASA selected SpaceX and Boeing as its future space taxi providers. These two companies have worked to build a spacecraft capable of safely carrying crew under contracts worth a total of $6.8 billion. Once operational, their vehicles, SpaceX Crew Dragon and Boeing's CST-100 Starliner, will be NASA's primary means of transporting astronauts to space. So cool. Ever since the final shuttle flight touchdown, every astronaut bound for the orbital outpost has hitched a ride on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft. Now, this flight marks the first, I didn't know that. Now, this flight marks the first official operational flight of the Crew Dragon's capsule. During the lead up to today's flight, NASA certified the spacecraft to carry astronauts to and from the space station on a regular basis. The four astronauts departed from the historic Launch Pad 39 at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. This is the same launch pad that the Apollo 11 astronauts launched to the moon from, and also hosted the first and last space shuttle launches. In fact, a total of 82 space shuttles launches left the platform from that pad. That heritage is also represented in the mission's patch. There are no names or flags in the patch. Instead, it has symbols on the new lower edge. On the lower edge, to pay tribute to the four previous U.S. spacecraft that carried astronauts, Space Shuttle, Apollo, Gemini, and Mercury. On Sunday, the quartet of astronauts traveled to the pad approximately 3 hours before the launch. They traveled in style, riding in white Tesla Model X electric cars that were decked out in the old NASA worm logo that was revived for the launch. Upon arrival, they took an elevator to the crew access arm, which stands approximately 260 feet or 81 meters above the launch pad, and then climbed into the capsule. After a series of system checkouts, the closeout crew detected a potential leak in the spacecraft's hatch. The team spent several minutes to troubleshoot this issue before they cleared the pad. According to the webcast, there could have been a small piece of debris in the hatch's seal, which would have been removed before the crew was sealed inside. Then they armed the Crew Dragon's abort system soon after. The system is a crucial component in keeping them safe. SpaceX then began fueling the rocket with supercooled liquid oxygen and kerosene 45 minutes before that. Before the crew could fly, SpaceX had to prove that its Crew Dragon capsule could keep astronauts safe during flight. One of the lessons learned from the loss of the Space Shuttle Challenger in 1986 was that all future crewed vehicles would need emergency escape systems, which the Space Shuttle did not have. While in flight, anomalies are rare. NASA needed to ensure that if one of SpaceX Falcon 9 rockets were to have an anomaly, its astronomers could still be brought home safely. As such, SpaceX demonstrated how the system worked in flight earlier this year. I love that word, anomaly. I remember in the time that Bruce Willis and his crew in a movie, forget what it's called, they went up and blew apart an asteroid. They were talking about, well, the thing coming toward us, and one of the people kept saying, it's an anomaly. The anomaly is coming closer to us. Okay, while in-flight anomalies are rare, NASA needed to ensure that if one of SpaceX Falcon rockets were to have an anomaly, its astronauts would still be brought home safely. As such, SpaceX demonstrated how the system worked in flight earlier this year. Following that successful in-flight abort mission, SpaceX launched two astronomers, Bob Ben Kine and Doug Hurley on a space flight to the International Space Station. During that flight, the duo put the Dragon spacecraft through its paces, spent about 10 weeks on station before splashing down on the Gulf of Mexico on November 2nd. So I'm going to go to the end of this article because my time running out. Crew 1 is expected to dock with the space station Monday, November 6th, 11 p.m. Eastern Time. And you can watch their arrival live here on space.com. They will remain parked at the orbital outpost for 6 months. Such a cool thing, people going into space. And of course, we have to acknowledge Baby Yoda. So Baby Yoda's on the space station. So thank you for listening. I hope everything's well and keep safe from COVID. This is Marco. You have been listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.